Hello and welcome to the 100th episode of Deluded, live from Mexico City. Nate, how are you feeling about it?
Very excited. I mean, you're just smiling like a Cheshire cat. Like you've
I just can't believe we got to 100 episodes. It's kind of incredible.
I can't believe someone didn't cancel us before then.
Well, luckily no one could.
I know.
Well, we made the decision to upload the episode, so it doesn't matter what the fans think. We're still here.
Honestly, it's extraordinary that we're not still on hiatus and we haven't been, you know, the whole show hasn't just gone down the gurgler. But yeah, no, we're here. Well done. Congratulations, kids.
Yeah, inspiring stuff, Nitz.
Very much so.
We are going to do a little bit of reminiscence about Deluded shortly, so please forgive us, indulge us for that. But let's talk about the game first. Pretty solid win this week. I'm starting to feel like we're a little bit like one of those really good teams where wins are a bit boring and predictable. That's how this felt.
Honestly, very much so. I was honestly extremely bored during the game.
Yeah. We were clearly going to win the whole time.
Yeah, absolutely. Carlton didn't even really challenge us. Even though the margin wasn't, you know, 70 points, they just always felt like, it always looked as if they were being outplayed, particularly because our defense is so, so rock solid.
Yeah.
And I just wasn't very kind of, nothing about the game excited me or enthralled me. I was just kind of like, oh yeah, moving on to the next one.
Do you think this is a bit like being a Hawthorn fan?
Yeah.
Like
a little
5 years
bit.
Ago?
Well, yeah. It's kind of like that point where you get to where you're like, oh, I just want finals to start already. Mm. Or like, oh, I just want to play the other top eight teams.
Yeah.
Once upon a time, I used to dread playing the other top eight teams because I would be like, oh gosh, now we're actually going to get exposed. This time around, I sort of sit there thinking, oh gosh, like, you know.
Yeah.
I just want the Bulldogs game to come round.
I know. We're all here for September, let's be honest.
Really? I mean, we're here for the premiership and nothing else.
What's been funny is for me, it started out as kind of, you know, a bit cynical and a bit downcast about every game. Now I honestly do think we'll win every game. And I'm really spreading that with a lot of smugness, you know. And I've realized that's actually quite fun, you know.
Very much so.
Yeah. And no one can disprove it. I mean, I know it's round nine, but we haven't been round nine since 1956, apparently, which is the last, not the last time we won a premiership, but it was a premiership year.
Yeah, exactly. And apparently every time we've been 9-0, we've won a premiership.
There you go.
Which has been twice in our history, but that's okay.
Quite a statistic.
Yeah, exactly. But let's talk about some highlights for the game.
Mm.
I think that the defense is obviously just sublime, as we've always talked about. Clary, excellent. Now he's second in the coaches' votes behind Hugh McLuggage. Is he a Smokey Brownlow chance? Because everyone's been talking about Christian Petrarca being this sort of obvious Brownlow contender for Melbourne. But I think Clary's kind of flying under the radar for what has been an excellent season.
Yeah, I think he's – is he first or second? He's first in the AFL for contested ball. And I think Petrarca's 19th in the coaches' votes. So it's kind of weird that no one's talking about Clary given his season. He absolutely could win the
premiership.
I mean, he's in everything.
Absolutely.
He's getting so much of the ball. And a lot of these kind of inside midfielders do pretty well in the Brownlow. So there's really no reason why he couldn't win it.
He's a little bit like Tom Liberatore insofar as Libba up until this week has been kind of flying on the under the radar for his excellent season and has been overshadowed a bit by the Bont and probably to a lesser extent Jack McRae. And so it's actually really interesting. I think that it'll be really fascinating to see what happens on Brownlow night.
Mm.
Yeah, with both of those players.
Absolutely. I'm stoked with him and very impressed with the forward line again. I mean, it's hard to know what to say about Tom McDonald because we use every superlative every week.
And killing it.
He just keeps improving.
Gone.
I mean, he's playing sensationally, Nitz. They're talking about him as an all-Australian forward, which
is extraordinary.
Kind of remarkable.
Given that he was on the trade table and they couldn't get him out the door quick enough last year, it's an unbelievable turnaround.
Yeah.
I mean, I still think there are a few question marks on Ben Brown and Wiedemann. I mean, it was Wiedemann's first game back from injury. Mm. So obviously,
and you're a huge Wiedemann fan.
I am. I'm a bit of a Weed fan.
He will literally jump and, I don't know, it'll hit his hands and drop, and you'll say, oh, great leading pattern or great contest or something.
Why do you
do not give that indulgence
snarky,
to anyone else?
Karen.
No, because he's one of your pets. It's
I
true.
Do. I love he's Sam Wiedemann. I do love Sam Wiedemann.
I like him too, but I think the jury's a little bit out on who makes our forward line because you've got Wiedemann and Brown who both look decent. I don't think they played badly. They were solid. But there's a pretty clear gap, I think, from them to Fritsch, McDonald and Jackson.
Well, they've also been injured. So it's always hard to compare players who are coming off, you know, long-term injuries and into the team in sort of round eight, round nine. But
Nitz, then tell me your prediction, okay? So round one of finals, we're obviously finished first.
Obviously.
Right? Unbeaten season.
Minor premiership sewn up.
Right.
Yeah.
We're playing Richmond, right? What do you do with the forward line? Who of Jackson, Wiedemann, and Brown do you play?
I think you play Jackson and Wiedemann.
Jackson and Wiedemann.
Yeah, okay. I think they're the most agile. I just think that they're more agile and athletic.
Mm.
And I think that Ben Brown, albeit being a wonderful set shot, I just think that maybe he's a bit too one-dimensional in his athleticism and, yeah, and in his abilities in the forward line. I do think that Weed and Jacko can provide greater pressure and just sort of fit in with our system a little bit better.
Yeah. Look, Ben Brown does look a little bit lumbering and a bit cumbersome, although Tom McDonald has looked like that at times as well. So I don't really know. I mean, my lean, as I've said before, is to have neither in the team, and maybe that's too risky in finals to have such an inexperienced forward line. But I love the way we look with my smaller forward line, with Fritsch just dominating, with Jackson floating around. Maybe Petrarca spends a bit of time up forward. To me, that's the best look. I feel like we might get a little bit too top-heavy with those other guys, but I mean, we're winning every game, so it doesn't really matter anyway, does it?
I mean, look, when you're just...
It's all just hypothetical.
Exactly.
Moving the magnets around for fun.
But let's talk a little bit about Deluded and the journey that we've been on. The journey, I mean, it was quite a trip to 100 episodes.
Mm. Well, as regular listeners would know, it is traditionally very hard to get Nita to agree to do the podcast.
I was a total Mariah Carey diva before every single
character.
Oh, before every single episode, I basically like screamed and wailed about how the talent shouldn't be doing this and the talents are better spent on other podcasts.
I think you thought Deluded was a bit beneath you.
150%,
which is a bit cruel, I thought. In fairness to you, it was a pretty mediocre operation at the start. No microphone, just recording straight into the computer.
That was a disaster.
That was very bad. The first episode, we had all these scripted jokes. I highly recommend people do not try and find our first episode.
No, please don't tell them about that.
It's so bad.
So embarrassing. Oh, honestly, I wish, can we just remove that from Apple?
No, because I think for the historians, it'll be important to see where
the Deluded historians, the people who are creating like a full anthology of our work. Yeah. No, so it was terrible. Then we had all these like quirky, albeit quite lame segments.
Oh, the segments aren't going away.
Like the Damien Barrett Award.
For outstanding achievement in the field of
journalism. Yep. Which usually went to Mark Robinson, really, let's be honest.
Or to Damien Barrett.
Or to Damien Barrett.
And then the Rowan Bale Award, which has stood the test of time, although we've forgotten about it the last few weeks, for most underrated performance. I think that's been good. Look, I've never gotten any positive or negative feedback about it, but we're sticking with that.
I think the ambivalence was enough of an affirmation for you, don't you think?
The ambivalence was like Rowan Bale's career. Yeah. But, you know. And then we had a lot of Cameron Pedersen talk and just, you know, we had our cult figures. Well, I guess I had my cult figures and usually wanted to list them over the years.
Very much so. And we also have to remember that you did propose to me through the Deluded podcast.
That's true.
In an episode that never was actually aired but was called Destiny.
That's
very
true.
Aptly.
That's true. A much longer story. Not as good as some of the other titles, though. I don't know if the fans care about this. Fans.
No, let's go have a look through the archives.
But we care with some classics. I'm looking back on Insane in the Membre.
Insane in the Membre was very good.
After Tim Membre destroyed us. Deja Vu. After we lost to Essendon in the exact same way 2 years in a row. Old MacDonald Had a Harms, which is yours.
That was mine. I can't remember why that was.
I don't really know what it meant. PTSD, Blame It on the Goody.
Blame It on the Goody was 100% me. But that's just because, I've always liked Michael Jackson up until the recent revelations. But yes, Blame It on the Goody was definitely my work. And Blood's on the D Floor after we lost to Sydney.
So we hope you like those.
And Why really Does It Always Rain on D's?
That was good, yeah. We do really run out of puns, but anyway. We've had some great contributors, Louis and James Robertson, some core supporters of the podcast, Josh Drake, a regular Richmond correspondent.
Always described as the most eloquent Richmond supporter that's ever walked the face of the earth.
Not saying much. Leo Harrell, who's become a good friend of ours, through Deluded.
Well, you have to explain how we met Leo, because this is quite an amazing story.
Well, we never met Leo.
Oh, shoot. We haven't met him in real life ever.
No. It's purely Deluded fan mail.
Oh, my God, you're right. Because he basically started sending you love letters, right?
Well, more Deluded love letters, but yeah. And we've loved having these kind of relationships, you know, all of the people who've joined the Deluded community. Thank you to all of you. So many names, so many people. Just makes us feel connected to something.
Very much so. And we've done some podcasts in some random places across the world, from Mexico City to Ibiza, where we were with, some of our other Deluded favorites like Tom Minifee and Will Richards.
Totally. No, it's been really nice. And we really want to thank everyone who's listened to and supported the podcast and sent us messages. I mean, we've been away from Australia for the last 5 years. 7 years, maybe, God knows, moved all over the place to Mexico now. And just having that community of demon supporters, it really does make you feel home.
Oh, it's incredible. And some of the people, like Warren Stampy, Terrence Langley, shout outs to you both. Another Demons fan actually wrote to me the other day. He is a Mexican guy living in Melbourne. And he is a massive fan of the D's. He might be the only Mexican D's supporter living in Melbourne.
Sensational.
And it's quite funny, actually, because he told me that he it became a D's supporter because his Mexican team is Los Diablos Rojos, which means like the Red Devils,
no
basically.
Way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they are also a tragic team from Toluca.
That's
so
amazing.
Very exciting.
That needs to be our Mexican soccer team.
Los Diablos Rojos.
Yeah, that's our team now.
Yeah, definitely.
That is fantastic. Well, thank you all. And thank you also for putting up with our many schemes to try and raise the listenership. Instagram was an unsuccessful foray, I think.
Well, this was brilliant. So Kieran thought that he was trying to be an influencer, basically rivaling the debrief, and he decided to post the same photo over and over again. So our Instagram feed was literally about 25 photos of I think it was Cam Pedersen's head, and it was the same photo over and over again, and he didn't seem to realize that this is not how you influence.
This is what happens when you leave social media to someone who doesn't have Instagram. But anyway, that was unsuccessful. But I feel like we've found what we're kind of into right now. We've had some good interviews this year, and we hope you guys are enjoying it. We're enjoying record listenership. I wouldn't say it'd pay the mortgage, but, you know, or really pay anything. But we've gotten some numbers.
It's validated our egos.
And so thank you all for listening and for leaving your comments and so on. And please join Deluded, the Melbourne Demons fan community, for more. Okay. We have rambled on for way too long about Deluded. Much more exciting is our interview with Melbourne's first female president, Kate Roffey. And I think one of her first interviews, which bizarrely is with the Deluded podcast.
What do you mean bizarrely? The Deluded podcast is like at the forefront of all media. What are you talking about?
It's a self-confidence issue, right?
Yeah.
But says some very interesting things. We talk about the progress on our home base, Simon Goodwin's contract.
Christian Petrarca's contract.
Christian Petrarca's contract. Melbourne's goals in terms of equity and diversity.
The AFLW competition.
AFLW, the circumstances of Glenn Bartlett leaving. Really some pretty broad terrain, and she was happy to answer everything.
She's great. Yeah, she's fantastic. We're obviously in such great hands with Kate Roffey leading the charge for the Melbourne Football Club. So, you know, I'm sure you guys will really enjoy this interview.
Absolutely. So we haven't even talked about the Adelaide game, but what's there to say? We're going to win by at least 40 points.
Naturally, yeah.
Yeah. Until next week, go D's.
Go D's. Kate Roffey, thank you so much for joining us on Deluded. It is such a pleasure to have the new president of the Melbourne Football Club, the 22nd president of the Melbourne Football Club, and the first female president on our 100th episode. So what a great honour it is for us.
Fantastic. I didn't realise I was on the Golden Jubilee, the 100th episode. So very excited to be here.
So, Kate, you grew up in rugby league country in northern New South Wales, and you came to AFL a bit later in life. Can you tell us a little bit about how you fell in love with the D's?
Yeah, so it is strange because where I grew up, which is a country town in the far northwest of New South Wales, so it's actually closer to Queensland than it is to Sydney, and about 7 hours closer to Queensland, in fact. So I grew up with League and Union, and I'm a Maroons supporter in the league and the state of origin, not a Blues supporter, which many people find strange. But we hadn't really heard of AFL. Just as I was probably finishing off high school, we started to hear about AFL as a sport, or VFL as it was back then. And then I went to Canberra to study and play sport myself in Canberra, and all of a sudden there were all these people who came from Melbourne who played Aussie rules. And so I actually started playing Aussie rules with our men's team at uni because we didn't have women's Aussie rules then. Of course, it was just such a great game. I was a reasonably good athlete in my day, and a friend and I, we used to play in with the men's team because it was so much fun. It was just a completely different game. The ball was always moving. There's no offside. There was no, you know, heavily running at each other, full pilt and tackling. So I really enjoyed the game, and then I took a job down here in Victoria, in Melbourne, as the CEO of an organisation called VicSport. And, of course, that represents all sporting groups in Victoria. And the first thing I was asked is, in fact, before I even got to Melbourne, I was asked, you know, who do I support in the AFL? And you don't have a team if you don't come from an AFL family or from AFL. is in your family bloodlines, then you don't have a reason particularly to support any team. So I got here and everyone was, you know, you've got to support the Bulldogs, you've got to support St Kilda, don't support Collingwood, everybody said, don't support Essendon in Canberra. That was a strange one. I found in the ACT it was Collingwood and Essendon I was told not to support for some reason. But I came to Melbourne and it just seemed like a natural thing for me, being heavily engaged in Melbourne and CEO of Fixport, to be a Melbourne Demons supporter. And I had a fabulous lady, Jane Nathan, who many people were listening will know. Jane, she's an avid D supporter, her whole family are, but she was a member of the MCC at the time, and she would be, you know, I think virtually every day pretty much, you've got to be a D supporter, got to be a D supporter. And then, I started following and I became a D supporter. We were not doing as well then as we are this year. And I, like everybody, every Aussie, I think, love an underdog. So I thought the Melbourne Demons, it will be. And here's the journey to the president of our fabulous football club.
So, Kate, you started supporting Melbourne because, much like a lot of us, you sort of felt sympathy for the underdog. Now that we are 9-0 and we are absolutely flying under your watch as president, how does that feel? And is that challenging your sort of identity as a Melbourne supporter in any way?
Absolutely not. Absolutely loving it. People say, oh, you know, kiss of death, don't talk about 9-0. I'm talking about it every time I stand up. I can assure you there isn't a president in the league who wouldn't rather be in my shoes at the moment, with a team that's unbeaten and, you know, really looking on the field like, and John Longmire said this after we played Sydney, and that was a tough game. I spoke to the men in the change room after that game and they said that was a really physically demanding game, it was a really tough game, but not once did they ever, ever, ever give up their desire to win. And I said this at the president's function when I was speaking just this weekend. I was standing on the edge of the field waiting for the Sydney match to finish and the ball kept getting bombed into the Sydney 50 and we kept defending, we'd hit it out and come back in, we'd defend and hit it out again. And on it went, and not once did our players ever, ever not go back and resolutely defend that goal line. And the reason they had that energy to keep going back was the crowd were just so frantic supporting them and willing them on. And I keep saying this is the difference now. We have a team that believe, but more importantly, we need all our supporters now to believe that we can do this, because if we believe, they believe, and if they believe, then they can do it. And I tell you for sure and certain, people like Serena Williams and Roger Federer, they never, ever cross a white line not believing that they can win. And so this is what people are saying, what's different now? I say it's maturing. There's all sorts of things that happen to get you to where you are when you can compete and actually win 9 in a row. But the thing that's going to make the difference now is that collective belief from every single Melbourne Demons supporter that we can actually do this.
That's great to hear. And, you know, obviously we've been abroad, but we have just been loving the journey, you know, staying up pretty much every night until 3 a.m. Mexico time to watch every weekend, rather, till 3 a.m. to watch the games, because they are so exciting. And it is wonderful to see a team which is so cohesive and functioning so well. I want to turn first to the AFLW competition, Kate, because you've served on the board for the past 8 years, since 2013, and I know you've been very instrumental in helping drive a successful not only Melbourne AFLW team, but also the expansion of the competition to 14 teams. Do you think that we should be moving faster to expand the league to 18 teams?
Yeah, look, I want to just touch on the AFL women's history, and we sort of talk about the five seasons that have been, but there's people like, and from our club in particular at Melbourne Football Club, there's people like Deb Lee and Jen Watts, who worked at the club for a long time, Karen Hayes, who was a director on the board before I was, who many, many, many years before we actually had an AFLW competition worked so hard to actually make this dream of women playing in the AFL competition proper a reality. And so we're starting to see now the culmination of so many years of work by so many people who came a long time before I came. And I'm, you know, another very proud link in that chain, and absolutely will do everything I can to keep our AFL women's competition growing. But as you asked, Nita, the rate at which it grows, is it's a bit of a two sides of the coin, because you look at it one way and say, okay, well, if we expand quickly, every team in the competition has a women's team and we all get to compete in a full competition. The flip side of the coin is if you expand too quickly, will it spread the pool of talent out too thinly? And we see that new teams come in and struggle for their first couple of years, not just because we've got to spread players out, but you have to gel as a team. It takes time to gather momentum as a team and to understand structure and to reach what we call unconscious competence as athletes, where you don't have to think about your skills and you can actually focus on team a bit more. So on those two sides of the coin, I guess it's just depends which side of the fence you sit on. I guess you can say just expand it quickly and then eventually it'll find the balance. Teams will even out and it'll take a few years and we'll have some really strong teams and we'll have some that aren't so strong, but it will eventually filter through and we'll have greater balance. Or do you say let's wait a bit more till we have a growing pool of talent coming through the VFL ranks, and then that provides more opportunities for more players of a skill level to come in and play at the AFL women's level. Pick a side of the fence. I think there's great arguments for both. I think the one thing that we are looking at now is we've just seen the season go to December start and to move away from the men's season, which is great in many ways. It gives that women's game its own airtime there. The other downside of that is that we don't have our men and women playing together and, you know, potentially playing curtain raisers for each other. The problem at the moment is that we have the same administrative staff and to some degree the same football staff working in both the men's and the women's program, and so it just becomes too unwieldy for us to have them running at the same time for too long at this point in time, because we quite seriously do have staff members who finish the women's match, get on a plane and fly off to work on the men's match the next day or vice versa. And so that's really the thing that's the problem at the moment is we've got that doubling up of resources. It's the same group of staff and particularly admin staff who are working in both leagues, and that makes it really difficult to have them running together. We ideally would like to see standalone leagues that, you know, the women's has its own resources and is resourced as well as the men's league, but that's a little bit away. So there's a lot of complicating factors there. The thing I'm most pleased about is to see that the competition is growing, the support for the competition is growing, and you cannot in any way watch those games and say that the skill level of those women playing the game is anything less than exceptional. It is a fantastic game to watch.
Okay, can I just ask a follow-up on that? So is this sort of, from what I gather, there is sort of a little bit of a strain in terms of resources insofar as you've got admin staff and coaching staff who are forced to fill both roles, really. Is that right? And so I guess my question is that sort of strain a result of the COVID soft cap cuts, or is that sort of pre-existing before that?
Yeah, no, it's pre-existing. I mean, we've added a whole another level of competition. We haven't added a whole another level of staffing, and that's the same for every club. The thing I say and the amazing thing about AFL, and people often ask me this and are often amazed when I say these are voluntary roles, all board roles are voluntary roles. We do it because we love it, and our staff do it because they love it, and they don't do it begrudgingly. They don't complain or anything. It just is, it's tiring and it can burn you out because, like everyone, I have to work to pay the mortgage and pay the electricity bills and things. So when our staff are in those positions, they happily do it, but it does take a toll, and that's the thing that we need to actually look at is how can we best balance that. And at the moment, one of the ways that we can balance it is by splitting the two seasons apart so that we don't have staff in the situation of quite literally having to jump on a plane and fly off to support either the men's or women's team, depending on who played first. So let's hope that changes in the future. But that's, you know, that's just the way it is, and we couldn't be prouder and happier that we're a pioneer of the women's game. And I know all our staff who support both the men's and women's team do it because they love those players and what they bring to the Melbourne Football Club.
Kate, one last question about the women's team. Now, I'm interested in what your vision is for the team, say, 5 years from now, because obviously in the men's competition, there's a very established competition, so you always talk about in terms of premierships, and I'm sure that a premiership for the women's team is obviously a crucial goal. But in terms more generally about how it's integrated into the club and the membership and so on, where do you want it to be in, say, 5 years from now?
Yeah, I think one of the great things, and we get a feel for this talking to other players and things, our women's team is well integrated into our club, and I was actually had some of our women players at our president's function on the weekend and some over representing us in the Coterie group, and I was chatting away to them, and we have players, so Libby Birch, for example, who plays in our back line and is obviously, if you're watching games, down there by herself as the absolute last line of defence. Liv was telling me that she spent a lot of time with Stephen May and Jake Lever talking to them about her game and how to help her game, and vice versa. The men are also learning a lot from the women in terms of being semi-professional athletes, in terms of someone like Shelley Scott who drives a couple of hours each way to training every time she comes to train. They're actually learning that what they have in terms of being able to play their sport as a full-time profession is something that's very exceptional. There's not a lot of people who get to do that. So they are really sharing and learning. I'm really pleased to hear that they do spend a lot of time together sharing and learning from each other's experiences. We can be a lot better, I think, across the VFLW in terms of supporting players, and, in fact, we have to be. And I know that's something that Nick Livingston and the group at AFL are working on as well, and it's something that we'll keep pushing until we do get, hopefully, to a point where we have a professional women's league as well as a professional men's league. And what do I want in the next 5 years? That'll be 5 women's premierships. Thank you very much.
I think we all want that as well. So, Kate,
absolutely.
I want to turn to facilities for a second. So we've been hearing for years about the club's plans to create a single world-class home-based combining training facilities, administration and a social club. You're obviously one of Australia's leading experts in facilities development given your role at Vic Sport. How close is the home base to becoming a reality, and what is your vision as to what that would look like?
So the vision, and I did the redevelopment of Melbourne Park, the place where the Australian Open Tennis is held here. I worked for Tennis Australia on that for 4 years, and I spent most of those 4 years travelling around the world, spending time with the Yankees and the Mets and the Dallas Cowboys and Manchester United and all sorts of professional sporting teams, looking at their facilities and their venues and things to get the best possible forethought that we could for the tennis. So a lot of that is now supporting us as the Melbourne Football Club as well. So the main thing with our facility is that it has to be a contemporary, world-class centre that has everything that we need, a football club. We want it to be a place where our administration and our football teams are together. So at the moment, our footy departments and our administration groups are in separate areas. It has to serve both our men's and our women's program equally. So that means that we need to have facilities in that building for both. And really, it's the place that's going to be our home for the next 30, 40, 50 years. So it has to be right. And you can imagine finding the perfect place isn't easy. So we've had a lot of different venues that we've looked at that for reasons don't add up. Either ovals are too small or there isn't land available. So while we don't have a clear answer yet, one of the things that has been a priority of mine for a long time, and I've been leading this facilities working group for a couple of years now, is actually to get an answer. And I think you can all hope, we can all sit there and say, well, wouldn't this be great? But if the answer is no, then the answer is no, you need to look at something else. So while I don't have the clear answer, we are working really hard with the government and the AFL at the moment on this, and it's an absolute priority. And we will have an answer on where it is going to be, hopefully sometime soon. I don't know what that answer is going to be yet, but we had the minister at our president's function on Sunday, and we spoke about that, and there's a lot of commitment here to actually get a resolution that's suitable for our club. It's an absolute priority for us.
Okay, turning to the on-field for a moment, obviously it's been a spectacular start to the year. Simon Goodwin has a deal until the end of next year. Will you be considering extending his deal this season, given all the hysteria around, say, Nathan Buckley's contract?
Oh, absolutely not. We haven't even, Goody hasn't spoken to me about it. I haven't spoken to him about it. It's not even, we are focused on next week's football game. You know, it's not even a thought in our mind. Funnily enough, I have heard it pop up in the media a couple of times, but no, absolutely not. We're entirely focused on, we're 9-0 at the moment. We're not even halfway through the season. There is a long, long way to go to finals, much less to getting a long way and deep into the finals themselves. So, you know, it's not even, until someone asked me about it the other day and until it came up in the media, it's not even something that's crossed my mind, and I'm absolutely certain it's not something that's crossed Woody's mind at all. We are focused on, you know, much more important things at this point in time, which is winning against Adelaide on the weekend.
And just another contract question, Kate. Christian Petrarca has obviously now signed up for 7 years. Tell us a little bit about your reaction to that news.
Yeah, so so we look at that as a board, because that's a long-term contract, and so we take into account, when we sign contracts up with players, our list managers do a lot of work behind the scenes to look at team structure, the players themselves, the whole salary cap thing out years. And we are in what we call our premiership window, and that's, you know, where your players, core group of players, have played their 150, 100 games, and they're sort of getting to that point. And keeping that core group together is critical. And we've also, don't forget, had Chris Salem sign up, and Christian, you know, I read this morning, I'm very pleased to see that people are talking about him as a potential, you know, Brownlow medalist, you know, top line player, because Christian Salem is a cracker as well. We've got Maxi Gorn, Jack Viney, who's, you know, blood bleeds red and blue. We've got a lot of players who've dedicated themselves to the future of this club. We've got Nathan Jones, who, you know, as a soldier, has been there since the day dot and never given up on this club. So signing someone like Chris, and, you know, he's definitely within the top 10 players of the AFL, and I would say in the top five, and, you know, climbing up the ladder rapidly. And there, absolutely, we want Chris as a focal point of our team going forward, as a key member of our core group. So in signing up that deal, we look at him as a player and him as a person. And I think that's really important as well, because there's no doubt, as you get older and towards your end of your playing career, as we see with Jonesy, you start to play a different role in the team, different sorts of leadership roles, and we're very confident that Christian Petrarca will be someone who is playing a very significant role still in the end of that, you know, sort of 7-year contract, and still contributing to the team. So we take all of that into account. One thing I will say is Chris is a fantastic person as well as a player. So I was speaking to young Bailey Laurie, who's got a quite unusual injury that sidelined him for a while, and I said, you know, maybe talk to Christian Petrarca, because when in his first year Christian did his knee, and I was talking to him, I'm a sports scientist by background, and I said, look, you will learn a lot from rehabbing this injury, Chris, and you'll probably be a much better player because you'll look after your body a lot more. So I said to Bailey, maybe have a chat to Christian, because I know he's been through it, and he said, oh, he's already been over and spoken to me about it and helping me out. To me, that's the sign that these players are great people, because they're caring for others without having to be asked. So they're the sorts of players we have at Melbourne Football Club, and they're definitely the sorts of players we want here for the long term.
So, Kate, I want to talk to you now about your, you know, some of the other sort of cultural questions around the Melbourne Football Club. So you've said that you want to use your platform to promote more equity issues and diversity and inclusion, and to have, I think you said that you want the clubs to reflect contemporary society in a lot of ways. You know, obviously the Melbourne Football Club has historically been associated with, you know, kind of private school, put out your cheese board type, that type of demographic, and that's not really reflective of contemporary society in a lot of ways. Can you give us some specifics on what you think you want the club to do differently in this space? Do you envision the Melbourne Football Club taking a more active role in the community, or what does that look like?
Yeah, and look, it is interesting, because I'm the absolute antithesis of what you've just said in terms of the perception of a Melbourne Football Club person. I grew up in country New South Wales. I went to my local primary and high school. You know, I paid my own way through university. So the key thing is that everyone, no matter where you come from, no matter what your background is, you are all welcome at the Melbourne Football Club if you're a Melbourne Football Club supporter. And I think that's the biggest thing that is resonating with people at the moment, that everybody is welcome, whether you've got $10 in your bank account or $10 million, you're all very, very, very welcome at the Melbourne Football Club. The inclusivity thing is an important thing to me because it is reflective of contemporary society, and it doesn't matter if it's a question about gender equity or inclusion of our Indigenous people or inclusion of people with a disability or inclusion of people from different ethnic backgrounds. That's contemporary society, and that's what we are at Melbourne Football Club. We want to be a big club on and off the field, and by big I mean, yes, we want to have a big membership number, but we want to be a big club that's respected. We want to be respected for what we do on and off the field. And we do a lot of that community work off the field. This evening I'm actually off to the launch for Neil Danaher's MND focal round, which will come up on Queen's birthday. We are off to Alice Springs in a couple of weeks where we're grassing the Santa Teresa Oval, which is the first grass oval that they'll actually have to play AFL on over there. We're involved in the Reach Foundation with Jimmy Steins. And so there's a whole lot of stuff that this club does in a community sense, and they're the things that make me so proud, is that we actually are out there doing things. And in speaking to Goody, for example, he's asked, what more can we do? You know, where else can we be? How else can we actually help? I know talking to Crystal Petrevsky, one of our AFL women's players, a lady at a function said, I'd love her to come and speak at our school. Crystal says, absolutely, very happy to go and speak to our young people. So there is a lot that happens there, and that's what makes me really proud to be president of this club. And I think that's what's resonating out there when people go, what's happening at the Melbourne Football Club? What's different is you're starting to see all of those big club things coming through, which is respect, it is diversity, it is inclusion, it is about caring for the community, and that's reflected on and off the field for us.
One follow-up to that, Kate. I think one thing that's distinctive about the AFL as a sport is its willingness to take on some pretty controversial issues, things like racism and homophobia and so on. And I'm interested to know whether you see the Melbourne Football Club taking a more active role in those spaces, because I have to be honest, I haven't noticed a huge amount from the Melbourne Club Football Club in those areas, but I might be missing it. So I'm interested to know what you're thinking on that.
Yeah, it's really interesting because we talked about me being the CEO of Vicsport some time ago, and when I was the CEO there, we had that discussion about the role that sport has in actually highlighting issues and in fact changing perceptions, because it's such a big thing. And there was a conversation that said it shouldn't be up to sport. We are a reflection of society, and society sometimes isn't great. But sport has got such a huge vehicle that it's got so many followers and people that are interested that it can change these decisions and it can change these debates. And I think that is important for us. And you may not see it, but I would say that, and I was asked about this recently, our Indigenous inclusion, for example, I think is very good. We have a RAP plan and those things, but our players are, really included. They're really part of the club. They're no different from anyone else. And I think this is all part of the reflection of Melbourne Football Club and what we want to be, in that, yes, if we can take the lead on some of these issues and actually take stronger stands. And there's some things that are unacceptable, and racism is unacceptable at our club. Intolerance is unacceptable at our club. And we've called it out before and we've dealt with it before. But hopefully the reason you maybe aren't seeing it as much is because we don't have as many of those issues. It doesn't mean we're perfect, doesn't mean we're great, but, we aim to be an inclusive and a respectful club, and hopefully that's how we're perceived, and that's what we're doing, certainly with our players and with our supporters and people who are involved in the club. Like I said, everyone is very, very welcome at this club, so long as they extend that respect and inclusivity to everybody else.
Mm. Kate, this question comes from a lot of our supporters who and listeners who obviously there was a transition in terms of the board this year, and you assume the presidency from Glenn Bartlett, who has been in the role since 2013. A change of president often happens when the club isn't performing and when, where things are going wrong, really, on field usually. And in this instance, the team is flying, the financials are great, you know, things seem to be quite fruitful for the club. So can you shed some light as to why the board decided that now was the right time for you to assume the mantle of presidency?
Yeah, so we have consistent conversations about succession planning, whether it's a board member or whether it's presidents, because there comes a time when it's time for change, and that becomes a personal thing as well. And people already are asking me, you know, how long will you do this? You know, and I say, I've got no idea. One, I am here because other people ask me to be here or choose for me to be here. You don't get your hand, you put your hand up one morning, wake up and say, I'm going to be the president of a football club. It's something that others ask you to do. And so we don't know when my time will come, but we will keep having those conversations about succession planning, because there will come a time when we might need a different focus, and that's what we looked at around our board. And there'll come a time when I actually say, I'm tired as well. You know, these are very, very tiring jobs. And anyone who saw Glenn speak when he announced he was stepping down, he said, I'm cooked. Those were his words, I'm cooked, because they do take a lot of time. And like I said, you do have to keep working elsewhere. So we'll consistently sit down and challenge and ask questions about who on our board needs to progress and move on at different times. And I hope that when my time comes, in the same way I can say it's my time to step down, and we'll have someone standing there waiting to take over the reins and be the right person at the right time, you know, to succeed for me as well. I don't know when that'll be, but it's an honest thing, because I'm sure, like any president of a club, I will, you know, miss it when I do choose to step down, and I'll, you know, miss all the things and the great things that come with leading this fantastic club. But there comes a time someone else needs to get a turn as well at some point in time. You can't keep it for yourself for too long. They're too great an honour to, you know, to sit there and stop everybody else from having their turn as well. But, yeah, it's a succession planning thing. We talk about it constantly. We talk about it at Noms and Rem. We talk about it amongst our board in terms of when directors come on, when we need skill sets that have changed. And, you know, I think it's a better time to do it when you aren't going badly, because then I would have inherited all sorts of off-field and on-field issues. So it's the best time to, you know, to hand on, and I hope I can hand the club on in a similar situation when I go.
So does that mean, Kate, that there wasn't any truth to the Age article suggesting that there was a board falling out with Glenn Butler?
No. Yeah, so we have you're welcome to go and ask any of my directors. We have an absolute, supportive, trusted board in there, and we have those open and honest conversations. And if people sit there and say, absolutely, we have differences of opinion around board tables. That's what a board is. I chair other boards, and I'm always encouraging people to bring up their thoughts and different ideas, because when we do that, we come up with the best ideas that we possibly can. But, you know, a board that challenges each other doesn't mean that it's a divided board or a board that's separating people. It's there's a lot of things that go on around a board table. I mean, people say we're presidents of football clubs, but first and foremost, we're chairs of boards, and we're company directors, and we've got duties of directors that we are required to fulfil. That's the first thing that we do, and then all the other bits and pieces come after that. First and foremost, we are the board of governance of the Melbourne Football Club.
And so, Kate, another question from our listeners is, obviously, we've done pretty well financially as a club, especially given what Peter Jackson basically walked into and Paul Ruse walked into back in 2013 and around about the time where you joined as well. What is the long-term plan to keep Melbourne financially stable? Because we've had this sort of well-timed exit from the gambling industry, but what's the sort of plan going forward to make sure that the club's balance books stay pretty healthy?
Yeah, look, and we talk about, you know, the strong financial position that we're in now, and that's been based or achieved off the back of decisions that were made by boards many years ago, you know, long before my time again, back, you know, Don McLarty and Pete Spargo and Russell Howcroft and people who were here before me. So running a football club, achieving success, I keep saying, is a long, long, long chain with a lot of links in it, and it's, you know, while I hope against hope that we win men's and women's premierships while I'm president, because purely for the fact I'm not going to be president for the next 20 years, so it means that we'll win one sooner rather than later. But I will just be another link in the chain that are potentially hands-on, hopefully the club in a good situation to someone else. So we will, as a board of directors and with our executive, make the best decisions that we possibly can to make sure that we continue to invest our money wisely, that we continue to make sure that we make the best decisions financially for this club, so that I'm able to hand it on to someone else in a sound financial position, and hopefully a better financial position than where we are now, and continue to build on that success that others have left us, and we're sort of able to build off now. So, like I said, it's not any one point in time that is definitive in terms of the success of this club. It's a long, long, long list of decisions that have made over a long period of time. And as a link in the chain, we'll do our best to make decisions that set the club up financially for the future, and then we'll trust those that come after us to carry the baton on and make sure we stay in the black, hopefully, as we go forward. But it's things like COVID hit. I mean, that was for every club out there, that was an incredibly difficult time. We have to thank our staff enormously, because they worked without pay. They took leave without pay. They used up their annual leave to keep this club going, and we owe them a world of thanks for getting us through COVID in the state that we got through.
Tell us a little bit about that, Kate, because I know that there's been a lot of reports recently about the number of injuries to key players in the AFL increasing because of cuts to, for example, conditioning staff. Then there's also been some discussion about, you know, assistant coaches having to, you know, take on other jobs just to be able to make ends meet. Tell us a little bit about how COVID impacted on the club.
Oh, there's no doubt that all clubs and the AFL was impacted enormously, and the financial impacts were seen, and we had to make cuts. Every club did make cuts. And as I said, our staff gave up a lot, and that's administrative staff as well as staff who work directly in the football department. They gave up a lot across all clubs to keep these clubs going during COVID, because don't forget, although the income wasn't necessarily coming in from ticket sales and things like that, we kept playing, so the expenses were still going out. And I think the AFL as well did a power of work to keep the competition going. In terms of the cuts and things, now we talk about this, and you know, some people say, look, the number of coaches and assistants and things has grown enormously over the years, and I hear former players saying you don't need that many. Others say, you know, it is taking a toll on the group that are there now, because they're working extraordinarily long hours, and that's true. But the thing I think with sitting around the soft caps and stuff like that is we need a clear answer on where it is going to sit, so we know what we can actually work with. And I think that's probably the more important question than, you know, what impacts it's having and how much it's going to be or whatever. Just be really clear about what it will be, so that we can actually be very clear with our people who work in football or in our administrative areas. This is what we actually have to work with, and these are the expectations. And so long as it's the same for every club, then I think that's okay. It only becomes a problem if you start to see differences in clubs in terms of, you know, they can have six extra people somehow and this club can't. So as long as it's across the board, and I think as long as we're clear what it is going to be and it's the same for everyone, then, you know, it is as it is going to be, because there's no doubt we've had a massive impact from COVID, and that impact is going to last years, not days. So we're going to have to work out a way to deal with the shortfall of income from the COVID year for a little bit longer yet.
Kate, we touched earlier on the, I think, unfair perception of Melbourne supporters as being, you know, private school, going to the snow in the Range Rover, mm-hmm. works. Which definitely doesn't seem to apply to the three of us, at least.
Yeah, definitely.
But kind of, we wish it did.
But kind of interested in...
Yeah, exactly. I wouldn't mind a Range Rover, personally.
That'd be lovely, yeah.
I would love one.
I'd love to know how to ski. But
from Jaguar Range Rover, our sponsors.
Of course.
Yeah, exactly.
But interested in knowing, what kind of stereotype do you want for the Melbourne Football Club in 10 or 20 years? What's the kind of identity we want for the club, if we can create it by ourselves?
Yeah. Look, you know, the identity is a mixed club. I think I love the fact that we have got people who have ski chalets and whatever, because they're huge supporters of the club, they're huge contributors to the club, and they're really important to it. But I also love that my good friend Charlie Lovett, for example, who's the president of the High Country Cattlemen's Association and lives up in the Snowy Mountains and has had horses all his life, and his family have, you know, caught wild brumbies from the Snowy Mountains all his life. I love the fact that his family are Melbourne supporters as well. So I think if we have an identity, it is that you can look in the crowd and see a sea of 20 different faces from 20 different backgrounds and 20 different socioeconomic statuses, and actually say they're all Melbourne supporters and they're all sitting together cheering our team on. To me, that's when we've achieved, you know, that total inclusivity. That's when we become that club that actually welcomes everybody, no matter where you come from. And you know, I look around and I'm seeing that now, because while there might be a perception, it might be, you know, fun to talk about in the media and thing, it's definitely not when you look in the crowd. It's not what you see when you actually look in the crowd. I see, you know, some mum and her three little kids stopped me downstairs after the game and asked that they have a selfie with me there. And they're, you know, they're kids who, you know, just come and love the footy there. So when we get to that point where, you know, you look at those faces and every face is a different face, then I think that's when we've gotten to that true inclusive sort of club that I would aspire for Melbourne Football Club to be.
Awesome. And final question for you, Kate. Thank you so much for everything and for your time today. But what is your final message to the D supporters listening to this podcast?
Yeah, look, I think, and I said this at the presence function, now is the time to believe. So you have to believe that we can do this. And even if we get behind on the scoreboard at some point in time, or even if we lose a game, God forbid, you have to keep believing, because I can tell you right now that our men and women, when they're out there playing, they can feel that belief. And when they're tired and when the scoreline is so close and it's, you know, it's an absolute throw of the dice who's going to win the game, it is going to be that support from the crowd and those people standing there in their red and blue jumpers and their red and blue scarves cheering the team on over the line. That's what's going to get them to the finals, and that is eventually what is, I have no doubt, going to one day get us another nice shiny Premiership Cup there. So it's not just up to the players, folks, it's up to you as supporters as well to get behind this team. Do not fall into that old trap of saying, oh, Melbourne's going to let us down, because they won't if we just believe in them.
Thank you so much, Kate, for joining us on Deluded.
Such a pleasure.
No worries. Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Go Ds.
Go Ds.